Lorena, here we are sitting on your lovely porch of your farmhouse at the center of the world. Where are we?
Well, we're about 10 miles out of Stratford, Ontario, in southern Ontario, and I've had this farmhouse for about 3 years. It's a wonderful old stone farmhouse dating to the 1830s and probably the closest thing I have to home at the moment.
It's really important for you, isn't it, a home base?
I think so. I think the more you travel, you're constantly redefining that sense of home. And although a physical house is not necessarily a home, as we've heard many people say, I think it definitely is the community of family and friends. But as far as a physical entity that allows me to engage in the natural world in ways that I like and feel comfortable, this physical place does a lot for that.
And a big black dog lying under the table.
That's right.
Where was your first home?
My first home was Morden, Manitoba, about 80 miles out of Winnipeg, and it was partially a Mennonite community, an Anglo-Saxon mix of Icelandic people, Ukrainian. A really wonderful rural kind of background to come from, I think. Very, very simple.
Your father was a cattle driver?
He was a livestock dealer. My mother was a nurse. She's retired now. My father's passed away. But I think growing up on the farm or around the farm and amongst the livestock business gave me a very earthy connection to the countryside. So it's not surprising that I would probably continue that connection.
There are people who are absolutely convinced that you're Irish.
Right.
Or from the Celtic part
right.
of the world.
No, I grew up in Morden for about the first 17 years of my life, and I can't say that there was anything overtly Irish about our household. My family background is such that my great-grandparents came from Ireland in the 1830s. And I suppose anything that was overtly Irish or Celtic about our household was probably more in the temperament. But I know that there are a lot of people who make the assumption that I come from Ireland. And indeed, I have spent a lot of time in Ireland over the years, particularly since the early 1980s, when I became very much smitten by the Celtic sound and felt this necessity to travel to the place of origin of this music.
Can you say what the draw was? You say the Celtic sound. What is that?
Well, I have always found it hard to articulate exactly what it is within Celtic music, let's say Irish, Scots, Welsh music, that it is, that draws people to it. It seems to function on a very involuntary, primal kind of way. And for a lot of people, including myself, I think that there's something in the older structure of the music, the rhythmic patterns, the drone aspect, that is very, very engaging. So I first became exposed to the Celtic music through a folk club in Winnipeg in the late 70s, and a number of members of that folk club came from Ireland and England, and they exposed me to a lot of the traditional repertoire and also the method in which it was expressed. It wasn't just the casual nature of this folk club where everybody took a turn in playing a piece and people would play along, that when I would ultimately go to Ireland and sit in a pub or go to somebody's home, it wouldn't be uncommon to encounter this very informal, casual extension of people's self-expression. And it wasn't just relegated to a concert hall or a more formal environment, which psychologically shifts the whole experience, I felt.
You studied piano and
voice. I studied classical piano for about 10 years, classical voice for about 5. And even though I can't say that I really surrender to the classical repertoire, I found that it did instill in me a strength of dynamics and technique and so on that I would then bring to the musical expression that I'm working in now.
That's a Celtic bark. You've mined beautifully English literature for a number of your songs. The Lady of Shalott on the Visit, mm-hmm. This time The Highwayman. But there must be people who had never either heard or appreciated these poems before who come away from having heard them, heard you sing them. I mean, you're doing a service to the English teachers to all over the world.
Dead Poet Society. Yes, I mean we being my offices get a lot of correspondence either by mail or by fax or by email, and a number of pieces of correspondence have been from people who have teachers, students, people who've really gotten into the literary aspect of it, and I would say if there is a disappointment in what I was not able to achieve in this recording was weaving in more classical material, as I have done over my past couple of recordings, because I felt that to give the recording weight by those classical voices was only a positive thing and gave it very, very sophisticated, different perspective than just my own. And I've never really felt that my lyric writing was the strongest aspect of what I do. And so that has been a lot of the inspiration of going to very sophisticated writers like Shakespeare or William Blake or Yeats, particularly. But anyway, I mean, in this recording, as with any journey, where you set off to go and where you end up are often very different places. And so it was with this recording.
Where did you start off to? Where did you want to go on the journey of this recording?
Well, I wasn't quite sure exactly where I would end up, but as with the previous recording, where I began was at a remnant of the previous recording to that, and with the visit, when I learned with the recording the visit, I learned the Celts were much more than this mad collection of anarchists from Scotland, Ireland, and Wales, and so on, but were this vast collection of tribes from Middle and Eastern Europe as far back as 500 BC. And I use that as that pan-Celtic history as a creative springboard. And there were various other things that were remaining at the end of that recording. But one of them particularly was getting an even further eastern glimpse of the Celts. So I thought, I'll begin in Italy. I'll see what was going on with the Celts in Italy, and if it takes me off in other directions, fine. Then as I started looking into the Celts and the Irish into Italy, I also learned that I'd read a wonderful book with the title of How the Irish Saved Civilization. A very preposterous kind of title.
Modest little
fame. And discovered, I know that there's been a lot of controversy over this book, but I think there's some aspect of its thesis that is, is sound historically. And that was that a lot of these monks who had been copying out ancient Greek and classical texts, religious and historical texts, illuminated manuscripts in their monastic communities in Ireland, reintroduced that classical material back onto the continent as the Roman Empire was disintegrating. And hence, they take the claim that had it not been for these monks reintroducing this material to the continent, that all this material would have been lost. And that one of the first first Irish religious community established in Italy was a place called Bobbio up in the north of Italy. And I remember thinking that in the high up in this very remote mountainous area, that if one was looking for the equivalent of the isolation some of these monks would have experienced on the Skellig Islands off the west coast of Ireland that are set, you know, off in the middle of the Atlantic Ocean, for goodness sake, that this was the mountainous equivalent of that kind of dramatic isolation. And hence, picked up on a thread of personal curiosity, well, more than curiosity, but that what it is for some people in a sense of isolation that they feel is necessary or and desirable in enhancing their connection with the essence called God.
Is that the case for you? Do you feel that strongly as the Celtic monks might have, that you need to be profoundly alone to come into your deepest contact?
I think I've come to the view which is more within the Sufi perspective, that you do not remove yourself from the world, you participate, that the opportunities that we experience in life are the things that cause us to grow. And so I think that isolated situations are good for different stages, perhaps, of one's own development. And I could certainly do a lot more of that. Mm-hmm. And I think it's coming up. I mean, it's very, very hard, I find, to have any appreciation of what a mind was all about in 5 centuries ago or 6 centuries ago, or any mind that is in the severest of isolated circumstances. But as many of these monks were, quite commonly very much physically alone with their books, and they only had the critters around them for company, they did take to this habit from time to time of writing their own little verses, and sometimes they were quite saucy little verses. it's also interesting when I was studying, when I was reading a book by a man called William Dalrymple called From the Holy Mountain, he was touching upon the connection of the illuminated manuscripts coming from the East and this whole migration of people that was going all around through Europe and North Africa, and how we've lost so many threads of those connections. Those historical connections of why the illuminated manuscripts that we now may so strongly associate with Ireland or Scotland, the Book of Duro, the Book of Kells, and so on, actually had their historical roots in the East.
Have you ever been a place where you felt, absolutely, I've been here before, or this, if I had lived in another lifetime, it would have been here?
Well, I mean, this whole business of reincarnation certainly comes up in the material from time to time, particularly with the Celts, similar to the native North Americans feeling overtly or inadvertently the souls of their ancestors were inherent in every living thing, and that there was, as a result, there was a tremendous respect for their natural world, but for myself, I can't say that that there's been any place I've been that I felt that I've been there before, or nor have I really felt that I wanted to necessarily live at another time. When you take into the broad context of what life, 100, 200, 500 years ago was like, because it's easy to romanticize about it what it was, but life was very, very, very hard, and the duration of your life was relatively short compared to what it is now, and disease and hardship and lawlessness and so on. So I feel very blessed to live at the time that I do and live the life that I do. But I still feel that there is a lot to be learned from the past. And for me, it's to try to find out what were the strengths in the history or historical or cultural configurations that maybe we've lost in this highly technological and very, very fast society that many of us in the West are living. And I think that is particularly something that has struck home to me in the past 3 years, and saying now I need to reconfigure how my time is spent, and that you allow more time for reflection, for digesting, that you can't just kind of absorb all this data all day long or all this information all day long without having the time or the circumstance to digest it and interpret it and spin it back out and so on. But
you've slowed down and you're taking on fewer engagements.
Yes, I'm looking at a lifestyle change after the release of this recording. At one point I thought I might go on to do a lot of promotion for it, and it may turn out that I will. But I think that I have this half-baked notion that we're actually quite an old creature, more primitive than perhaps we think we are, and we are. Our capacities are relative to a scale that we can only take in so much information so fast, and I feel that my life, particularly because I've been managing my career as well as being the artist, has encompassed far too much activity, far too much information, and I need to engage in life in a different way.
How do you label your music now?
Well, it's funny about labels because it's been a function of the industry more than I think the creative person or, let's say, the average person on the street. They just want to hear music. If they like it, they don't care what it's called. They just go for it. I mean, there are hours I call it sort of eclectic Celtic. But in one sense, it is a world music kind of expression. There are many people who associate world music with primarily African music. So clearly, it's not African music.
Although you've been in Morocco,
but
and
I
you've
have
taken
been in Morocco. Yes,
from Africa.
Yes. But I would say that it is a kind of world music, and insofar as that the commercial music scene has broadened considerably in terms of its influences, it can be, you know, found in the pop bin and in the
New Age bin.
New Age, Celtic, folk.
You've never liked being called New Age, have you?
No. I've found that almost any categorization has its preconceptions of what it is, and I think that this music is really clearly straddles a lot of things. The number of the musicians that I work with come from a wide range of musical styles: jazz, Latin, world music, very innovative new music. I come from a classical and a folk background, so when you weave in all those sensitivities and sensibilities in the playing and the style of the playing with the eclectic arrangement of the instruments, with a cello next to a doombeck or an Irish piper next to a sarangi, I mean, it's hard to label, really. That suits me fine because I've never been a club kind of person.
No kidding. You have almost a cult following, people who go long distances and regularly to hear you.
Yes, I mean, there's unbelievable diversity in the range of ages, and I mean, the recordings are released in over 40 countries around the world. There are truck drivers, archaeology professors, therapists, school teachers, 5-year-old children, 16-year-old goth kind of kids, heavy metal people, classical music lovers. It's really quite interesting to look at the people who come into the recordings or into the concerts or who write to us. I'm very loath to try to say what it is. I don't want to say that there is something, you know, supernatural or extraordinary in that way about what I do. But I think that I'd like to think that part of what I do is there's some measure of emotional honesty and vulnerability that isn't, you know, every day found in a lot of other music. And that kind of openness or vulnerability that is evident in the way I sing or what I sing, but it is something that people are attracted to.
You put a quotation in your liner notes from Sufi teaching that music and singing do not produce in the heart that which isn't in it.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
What did that say to you?
Well, I think, you know, insofar as that there are hidden jewels, there are hidden strengths, and often people are unaware of their own inner goodness. And I mean, my interpretation is that music, in its very invisible and very yet sometimes very powerful force, can stir up things in you in a very primal kind of way that that are lying dormant, perhaps, in you. And it is also connected to the Sufic concept of polishing the mirror of your soul, that things come inner, that as you go through life, you and trying to refine yourself and strengthen the connection to that essence called God and reach, work towards perfection, is that these are all mechanisms of looking at yourself or working your way through life that is very important. So you do not remove yourself from, you know, engagement with the world or even confrontation with the world. You use each of those opportunities to do something good for somebody else or for something else. And that's a really wonderful sentiment.
The Sufis are also really eloquent on the subject of music and sound and the voice. Is that an element that appeals to you? They say the soul expresses itself most vividly through the voice.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Yes, it is of interest, and I feel I'm just, that's a whole area that I am just beginning to learn.
What have you discovered about yourself through the journey of this recording that you didn't know when you started out?
Well, that's a very good question. I think in a lot of cases that it has expanded things that I've been starting to realize, that, you know, the world is far, far more complex than one can ever possibly imagine when you start examining the history behind situations, whether it's the history behind Northern Ireland or the history behind, you know, the Turkish political situation now. You cannot disconnect yourself from your history. And at the same time, I've developed this heightened awareness that we are this culmination of our collective histories. And as a result of that, I feel philosophically there is more to bind us together than to be fighting amongst ourselves, because we, you know, we are just such an extension of each other's history. But I did want to just, you know, shine a spotlight on this whole strata of history, this little moment of history where people were traveling to the East and coming back to the West, not only with physical things, but with songs, with stories, with recipes, and ways of articulating ideas, you know. And again, how information traveled is a fascinating subject alone. And now when we're at the threshold of, or in the midst of, huge technological developments that are causing information to move in very dramatic ways and having huge impacts on our lives, it's fascinating to look back at other periods of time and how media was handled, who had control of it, information, that there were principles that applied then that apply now, for example.
Such as?
Well, I mean, this sort of gets into one of the areas that where I landed upon the title of the Book of Secrets, that I was reading, or trying to read. It's a very thick academic book called Science and the Secrets of Nature that got into the history of science. And one of the aspects it touched upon were these brotherhoods, in these Islamic brotherhoods in North Africa, and the whole Arabic culture, studying astronomy, mathematics, and science into alchemy, and that, for example, they were discovering and trying to explore phenomena, let's say, like magnetism, which is invisible. They were establishing principles that of the visible and the invisible powers, and that the objective of alchemy was not necessarily to turn base metals into gold. It was to try to identify a harmonious balance within substances,
and in the self.
I mean, very much in the self. I mean, they used all this physical exploration, and then in their very spiritual, metaphorical expression. But they were coming, you know, and as that information came west, that people became very careful about how secrets of things were handled, or, you know, recipes of things were handled. So one can extrapolate that to our day and age, where you're talking about the capacity to build atomic bombs. Well, do you want to give that recipe on the internet or everywhere where everybody can put it in the daily newspapers? So it gets into this very difficult ethical and moral dilemma of how information should be disseminated and handled, and who should have control. So it was from the examination of that book, The Science and the Secrets of Nature and the Handling of Information and the Evolution of Science, that I first landed upon the title. And as with my previous recordings, I'm always trying to find that title over which many subjects can resonate in different ways and in different... in different ways.
Some people are going to read the title Book of Secrets as being more personal than this kind of exploration you're speaking of.
Mm-hmm.
That there are people want to know about you, but you're a very private person.
Yes, I mean, of one of the things that I've chosen not to do through my music, which many other artists have, is to it to be, you know, an expression or a document of their own self. I don't feel that I have that need in that way. I quite like the idea that I can use the music as this vehicle to explore various subjects and themes that are fascinating to me, and marry my talents or skills with that, and travel and perform and so on. I just don't feel that I personally am that important. I think all the rest of these other subjects and corners of history are far more important than I am. So I don't.
So we should be careful about reading into the Lady of Shalott or Serenissima.
I mean, yes, absolutely. I mean, there's no question that the manner of research. I see this recording like a collection of eight travel stories. It's more musical travel writing than anything, where a person is marrying some historical detail with their own personal experiences. So, and I love travel writing. I love Bruce Chatwin or Jonathan Rabin, etc. And I find that their personal experience and tack in a place or to do with a particular theme has allowed me to engage in a way that I'm not sure that I otherwise would have. And if I can be that kind of conduit for other people, that's great. But in the most immediate sense, I see the research, the recording that results from all of this is really a personal document of my own exploration. And I not to go and sell one recording. It's, in one sense, it's of no consequence to me because I've used it in this whole other way for my own interest and development. I do recognize it as an inherent part of of who I am is this insatiable curiosity that causes me to get engaged in subjects that I'm not satisfied until I give a good shot at traveling to these places. And I think that the fascinating thing about traveling is that, you know, it just allows you to pick up far more information on a very sensual level. So, for example, when I was in Marrakesh doing research for the Mask and Mirror, you go into that market, and this was during Ramadan, so there people had been fasting all day long and people, you know, chilling out. And then in the evening, the market, when the fast was broken, the market would spring into this unbelievable cacophony of sight and sound and smell. And so to be able to travel to those places just feeds, for me, it feeds a lot of that creative, it just fills the wood stack, as it were, in terms of when it comes to actually painting a picture, musically speaking, all that imagery, sensual imagery, comes wafting back to me. And then I say, okay, now I'm going to try to re-articulate that through the music and the ideas.
But what you're saying now is that this time of reflection that you need may not necessarily come out in music for a while yet, or if ever.
Yes. I mean, you know, who knows what will happen. I think for my part, I just feel like I don't want to make any plans except to release myself from a large strata, not entirely, but a large strata of my responsibilities. And so I have more time to sink more roots in, and whatever those roots are, whether it's in terms of relationships and family and friends and community, or just roots of experiencing, you know, the simple sensual beauty of sitting out on a summer's evening. And, you know, it's it doesn't get any better or more complex than this. So if you're constantly distracted by things, you don't have time to sink that kind of root into your own life's experience.
Lorena, thank you.
Thank you.